In the matter of DCPP versus JR-R and GR-R, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Yes. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Laura Kalick, designated counsel on behalf of JRR.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Beth Ann Hahn, designated counsel, appearing on behalf of defendant appellant GRR.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Stephen Resnick from Ziegler Resnick and Epstein on behalf of Amicus, New Jersey Association for Justice Matrimonial Committee.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Sarah Gregory, Deputy Attorney General on behalf of the New Jersey Division of Child Protection and Permanency.
Good morning, good afternoon as well, Your Honors. Noel Devlin of the Public Defender's Office on behalf of GR-R Jr.
Thank you, counsel, and welcome. Ms. Kalick, please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to respectfully reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal before I begin.
That's fine.
With the court, the primary issue in this case is whether a defendant parent in an abuse and neglect action under Title IX is entitled to receive notice prior to the burden being shifted and prior to the close of evidence. The courts below failed to recognize that JRR, the mother in this case, my client, was deprived of her fundamental due process right, her right to a meaningful opportunity to be heard and to respond. The courts below disregarded the express understanding that was placed on the record in which defense counsel stated that she did not bear the burden of proof and did not want to be walking in blind. But this is exactly what happened at trial. At trial, at the close of the division's case, the division did not ask for a finding that it had established a prima facie case pursuant to NJSA 9:6-842A2. Instead, the court waited until after the close of all the evidence and until the defendants had rested to shift the burden of proof to the defendants. In that case, they walked in blindly, and it was inevitable that they were going to be found guilty or culpable because they didn't know that they were bearing the burden of proof. This flawed and unconstitutional process below that was affirmed by the appellate division should not have been permitted. The appellate division disregarded longstanding principles of due process that this court has followed, starting with RD about 10 years ago, and most recently, this court in SC versus Department of Children and Families recognized that there were significant concerns regarding due process and significant issues and fundamental issues related to due process that had to be dealt with in an administrative action by the Department of Children and Families. The courts below also misapplied DT in interpreting the burden shifting statute to allow the shifting of conditional res ipsa to the defendants when the court in DT had specifically held that this was only that it was a limited situation and that they only intended their holding to apply in cases of monitorship and supervision. In this case, JL should have been controlling. JL was the correct interpretation of the statute in this case, in which it applied the principles of traditional res ipsa, which required that the court could grant the division an inference that the prima facie case had been made, but the burden of proof would not shift to the parents. Instead, the parents could rebut the case or come forward with an explanation for the causes for the injuries. Equally important, the application of DT infringed upon the parents' procedural due process rights. It's important to remember that Title IX abuse and neglect actions are punitive and also quasi-criminal, and they implicate fundamental due process rights. Finally, it is our position that prior to the beginning of a trial for abuse and neglect, the division should be required to give clear, meaningful notice that it intends to apply to shift the burden. And at the close of the division's case, the trial court should make a finding specifying whether the division has indeed established a prima facie case, and if the burden will be shifted, and if so, the nature of that burden that will be shifted. And then the court should allow the defendants sufficient opportunity to rebut and prepare its defense. For all these reasons, JRR urges this court to reverse the decision below. I'm happy to take any questions that the court may have.
Counsel, I want to start out with a very fundamental question, and it pertains to what I think is the operative statute concerning the burden of proof, NJSA 9:6-8.46b. And I'll just quote it. In a fact-finding hearing, any determination that the child is an abused or neglected child must be based on a preponderance of the evidence, and only competent material and relevant evidence may be admitted. Is that the operative statute?
The operative statute is yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so here's my question. Anderson versus Somburg was a common law case where the court is able to establish the burdens of proof and whether they shift. We're dealing here with a statute that places the burden on the division. Based upon that statutory requirement that the division has to prove the case by preponderance of the evidence, how could we ever apply conditional res ipsa, which is flipping the burden of proof on the parents?
Exactly, Justice Alvin. I agree. The burden in the Anderson versus Somburg was a very limited tort case, a medical malpractice case, and that was only supposed to be applied under certain circumstances. And the court in DT recognized that, and they said, we're not going to apply that in a case that is punitive, like abuse and neglect. Perhaps use it in a monitorship or supervision type of case. And so the correct interpretation is the traditional res ipsa burden as set forth in the statute, where it's just an inference that is shifted and then the parents come
forward. In this case, okay, assume that the burden has to remain on the division. Yes. The division has presented expert testimony, okay, of abuse and neglect, correct? This is not a case where the division needs a res ipsa inference. The plaintiff needs a res ipsa inference in order to typically to surmount a summary judgment where they don't have expert testimony. Like elevated doors close on someone, no expert testimony. Okay. The act itself bespeaks negligence. I don't see how res ipsa, if you're using the traditional notion of it, is even necessary here when the state has presented evidence, if believed, forget about who may be culpable, is sufficient to prove abuse and neglect. Do you agree with that?
Well, I would say I have 3 points with regard to that. And in general, yes, I would agree with that. The first point is that this issue was never raised below. And I know the division brings this up in their supplemental brief, but both the trial court and the appellate courts cited to DT and relied on DT and affirmed the use of DT, DT form of burden shifting. And also, the appellate division did address which burden application shifting paradigm was applicable. So those are really the issues on the case. And the third thing is that even if there had been, if it was just a preponderance of evidence, there certainly wasn't enough evidence to find either parent liable or culpable, because even the trial court said there was no information about who did what to who. I don't have to decide who did what to who, and the appellate division as well.
One of the reasons why I'm raising the statute is because we should typically not be reaching constitutional issues when the statute provides the answer to us. And if the statute is saying that the division has the burden of proof here, and does not provide for any burden shifting, why do we have to even reach this constitutional issue?
I agree, Your Honor. It's mainly based on the section of the statute 9:6-8468A2, which says proof of injury sustained by a child shall be proof.
Is there anything during the hearing that prevents the division from calling the parents to testify against each other?
There's nothing that would prevent that. Correct. There's a lot of options the division has. And the division doesn't have to seek a finding against the parents. They could seek a protective order. They could order of supervision. Or if they're very concerned, they could file a Title 30 guardianship action.
Well, the division, based upon the evidence it presented, showed that the primary caretaker was JR, correct?
That's correct.
If the division wanted to show that GR had as much contact with the child as JR, one of the options would have been to call JR as a witness. Am I mistaken?
That's correct. Yes, I agree, Your Honor. Yes. Any other questions?
Anything else you'd like to present, Ms. Kalin?
Thank you, I'd like to rest.
Thank you. Ms. Hahn.
Before I could begin, if I could just request a couple of minutes for rebuttal, please.
It's fine.
Okay, thank you. May it please the court. I am here today to ask that this court reverse the lower court's decisions, and I will explain to the court why this is the right thing to do. Res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself, is a tort law doctrine. Beginning back in 1975, this court's decision in Anderson versus Somburg, the traditional and the conditional were distinguished from one another, and the court applied in a medical malpractice case the conditional approach, whereby the actual burden of proof or persuasion would shift to the defendants in a medical malpractice case, or if the defendants were unable to exculpate themselves, they would face liability. The facts of that scenario were a surgical procedure during a finite period of time with a finite number of persons present, the surgical team. And importantly, notice of this shifted burden was contemplated by the court when the court stated the defendants should be called forward and made to prove their freedom from liability. Now, in a series of tort law decisions that followed, our courts continued to further refine the traditional and conditional variants of res ipsa. Traditional was explained as requiring only an explanatory account, whereas conditional would require an exculpatory account of injuries or an accident. Anderson was held to be an exception, limited to a particular set of circumstances in a medical malpractice case, with one court observing, the plaintiff would usually wait to request a shifted burden into the end of its case, thus reaffirming the defense must have adequate notice and opportunity to prepare. In the midst of these tort decisions, in 1988, we have the In Re DT decision, an appellate division decision, where the appellate court very cautiously applied conditional res ipsa in a child welfare matter. There, a four-month-old was indisputably sexually abused during a finite time frame, while in the care of a limited number of persons. The child's condition spoke for itself. She had extensive interior and exterior genital bruising and abrasions and tested positive for chlamydia. The court held the defendants, who should be noticed of their shifted burden of proof, would be required to prove their non-culpability in order for the state's complaint to be dismissed in its entirety. The court was emphatic that its decision was limited to instances where neither punitive relief nor damages were sought, but instead only limited to the monitorship of an admittedly abused child. The court also clarified this decision did not assign a fault to any defendant. The outcome did not implicate custody or parental rights and was limited to whether it was proper for the trial court to dismiss the case because the division had unable to prove who did what. As clearly, conditional res ipsa has no place in this instance, in this matter. This Title IX prosecution was for purposes of punishing his parents with custody and parental rights on the line and the high stakes of lifelong listing on the state's registry of child abusers. Indeed, in Fall and Romanowski, they've observed that DT had, or at least should have, limited further application. For example, then, in 2016, a case again involving unexplained injuries, the court characterized DT as the rare outlier of a case and a decision fashioned to permit the state to engage in limited monitoring of a family. Now, in 2008, we have the Dyfus versus JL decision, where the appellate division observed that in certain instances, traditional res ipsa would apply. In that case, where there were many unknowns, such as when a child's injuries occurred, or even if they were injuries, and where the number of persons involved was uncertain. In such instances, the defendant would have the burden of production of coming forward with some explanatory evidence. Notably, in JL, the division made a motion for the burden to be shifted, which was granted by the trial court, and thus the parents were on notice of the allegations for which they might provide an explanation. But the GL approach is not without its problems. The Chin versus St. Barnabas decision, where we get that explanatory evidence standard from, well, with that, there exists a vacuum to the quantity and quality of evidence necessary for any such explanation. Here, the court found the defense's expert, who testified with great authority and great credentials, to be credible and even captivating. The defense expert offered explanations within a reasonable degree of medical certainty for what appeared to be a child's injuries, which, as we all know, the child's condition was terribly complicated by the meningitis diagnosis. Anything beyond this explanatory requirement would be a de facto shifting of the state's burden, requiring the defense's explanation be by a preponderance of the evidence. And as per the DT decision, this is wrong in a punitive Title IX prosecution. These nuances are perhaps why this court has likened the law surrounding shifted burdens to murky waters in State versus Gant. Plainly, any manner of shifted burden was inappropriate in this matter because of the remedy sought, the fundamental constitutional rights of the parents, and the quasi-criminal nature of the proceeding. And recall too that parental rights, this court has held, are individual in nature. In sum, this was a case where a father clarified pre-trial he did not have the burden of proof, and thus he rightly focused on giving evidence or an explanation for what appeared to be injuries were not the result of inflicted trauma. But he was blindsided, and the court announced after a close of evidence that it had openly, the court stated it had applied DT after the close of evidence, thus depriving Mr. RR the opportunity to exonerate himself. Where the allocation of the burden of proof or persuasion is at issue, the failure of a trial court to allocate it clearly or a sudden change in its allocation severely prejudices a party. That's Blitz versus Hutchinson. This is especially so here, given that the state never even suggested it had made out a prima facie case, and the court never so stated either. The respondents here have argued the burden shifting matters are simple. And to some measure, Mr. RR agrees. What is simple here is that in child welfare matters, shifted burdens are permissible only where neither punitive relief nor damages are sought and fault is not assigned. Reversing this matter and reaffirming that burden shifting is limited to the monitorship of a child's safety would clear the murky waters that have led us to this place. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Why haven't you mentioned the statute? I've listened to your opening for 5 minutes. We have a statute that governs the burden of proof. Why have you not even mentioned the statute?
We have the two statutes, right, where the state traditionally, whether under Title IX, a preponderance of the evidence, or a Title 30 termination case, the burden of clear and convincing evidence. That's correct. We even have the statute regarding when there's a prima facie case, certainly.
No. The statute in a child, the burden of proof in a child abuse case, according to 9:6-8.46, is by preponderance of the evidence.
Correct. Yeah, there's statutory provisions regarding burdens.
Shouldn't we be starting with the plain language of the statute? The statute does not mention anything about the burden of proof ever shifting to the parents. Why doesn't Why isn't that the beginning and the end of the discussion?
Well, right. I mean, in that capacity, Your Honor, I would argue that burden shifting really has no place. The state has the burden per statute. The state has the burden, you know, per the statute. We got in this burden shifting universe, you know, decades ago when we had a limited decision coming out in DT where the court, you know, concerned about the safety of a child in a case where, you know, the state couldn't prove who did what, but the child was obviously abused, wanted to have some manner of protecting the child and, you know, determining it was inappropriate at that stage anyway to dismiss the state's case at the trial level. But, you know, this is not me coming forward with this concept of burden shifting. This began, you know, back in first with the 1975, you know, tort law case, and then morphed its way into child welfare law in 1988.
But this court has never spoken to the issue. We never.
No.
So you're here.
You're right. That's why we're here. Absolutely. But, you know, we've had a whole series. We have had a whole series of, as I briefed, we've had a whole series of decisions where this burden shifting keeps coming up, and it's very unclear whether it's conditional, traditional, you know, a series of appellate division decisions, both published and unpublished. So, you know, that's why we're here before Your Honors.
Does the statute address the question of the application of traditional res ipsa principles? Would they be barred?
Certainly, I forget my mind is going to go blank here before Your Honors with the exact subsection, but certainly there is the statute, I believe Ms. Kayla quoted, whereby the condition of a child, not normally explainable absent, you know, an act or omission on the part of a caretaker, would be prima facie evidence. And that's where I think we get into, you know, burden shifting cases are so fraught with confusion over the years. You know, even if it were a traditional case, that prima facie, you have to rebut the state's case, you know, what quantum of proof, explanation, evidence, quality of evidence is required?
Well, race ipsa are only, it's a permissive inference.
Certainly.
We permit permissive inferences in all circumstances.
Sure.
In this particular case, the division really doesn't need the benefit of a permissive inference because they have a ton of evidence that is suggesting abuse and neglect.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously on behalf of my client, I dispute that. I believe the experts,
at least enough to get before the trier of fact.
Sure. Yeah. And, but then, you know, we had the issue with lack of notice. The you know, the specific facts of this case are what they are, where the defense tried to confirm they would not bear the burden of proof. So they rightly focused on defending or explaining, if you will, what appeared to be injuries, but they were not on notice. It was going to come down to who did what, in which instance, you know, the parents would have had different options available to them had they known that that's the world we were moving into.
Do you concede that the expert produced by the parents did not rebut all of the evidence that was provided by the state's expert regarding the various injuries and explanation for the injuries? As the trial court described it, he was trying, the parents expert was poking some holes in various aspects of it, but did not address all of the injuries that were documented through medical evidence for Gabriel, I'll call him Gabriel.
Right. I mean, on behalf of my client, I respectfully disagree with that and your characterization of that in part.
I'm asking the question.
Yeah. So one of the trial court's problems with the defense expert was, you know, pointing out the fact that he was paid to be there to poke holes and that kind of like called into question. So that's one, you know, issue in my mind is, well, of course the defense expert was paid to be there. That shouldn't be disqualifying. No, I think the defense expert really covered all the bases. And if you read through,
well, I don't think he covered some of the explanation for the heightened enzyme readings that indicated trauma to the abdomen. There was,
right,
I don't recall seeing any response for that.
Right. So if you read, I do have probably some references to the record here, but if you read the trial court's decision, and I think even you know, the Office of the Law Guardian agreed, it really boiled down to the lipase level, as you say, and perhaps the swelling of the neck ligaments. So we had, Dr. Scheller discussed the lipase level, and the elevated lipase level would be due to some sort of internal, you know, trauma to an organ, right?
Blunt trauma.
Right.
Blunt trauma.
Yeah, but the issue here then is even per Dr. DeJong's testimony, there was really no external or interior evidence of any organ having been injured, anything wrong with any organ any, you know, external bruising. And I think there is authority in one of my submissions that, you know, sometimes this elevated light base level is like a matter of like overdiagnosis, something that may not even be present. I know Dr. Scheller referenced a number of different publications in his testimony. So certainly I do believe the defense expert adequately addressed that. And, you know, Dr. DeJohn was not exactly unequivocal in his concerns about that either, because he did admit there could be, you know, any number of reasons why that might occur. And then again, we don't have that physical evidence here, internal, external, that there was anything that would have caused that aberration in the light base levels. And specifically too, we had no lab reports, you know, reflecting how elevated it was or anything, you know, any baseline to compare what the child's condition was previously. So you're saying
there was not an adequate basis to find, based on a preponderance, that the trial court could conclude there was evidence of abuse and neglect here?
Well, of course, that's the position I'm going to take on behalf of my client. I believe they adequately rebutted the case. And certainly, you know, when we get into that, the world of burden shifting, right, even assuming JL had been the proper approach or DT, it's the opportunity to exonerate himself.
So my question is focused on, is there enough evidence that this child was abused, neglected, and injured, or are you focusing on being able to prove who did it?
Well, I'm kind of working with the cards I've been dealt in this case. Now, you know, obviously being a zealous advocate, I'm going to say that we, you know, came under a traditional approach, rebutted the state's case with Dr. Scheller's testimony and even the division's case itself. Some of the, you know, Dr. DeJohn was hardly unequivocal, right? But even, all right, for, you know, purposes of this conceding, okay, we got from point A to point B, and point B being, okay, who did what? And that's where this whole, you know, it gets all kind of tied up with this idea of burden shifting. JL, DT, where are we? And the notice the parents should have, okay, explaining what might look like injuries, right? And then—
Well, they did do that, didn't they? That's why they produced their expert. They had notice of what they needed to meet with respect to the injuries, didn't they?
I would say they wanted to provide an explanation. They wanted to defend the state's case. You have the defense counsel saying, though, just clarifying, we're going to be ready to go to trial. If we don't have the burden here, we don't want to walk in blind, right? Indicating, okay, perhaps counsel had some idea of what's going on here, but specifically clarifying they didn't have the burden of proof, and that impacted upon the preparation of their case, which was, you know, this couple presenting as aligned at that time and using the same expert. But had it been clear that this was going to be a DTL, you know, case, or a DT case, pardon me, you know, they would have had different options available to them.
Your argument,
my client may have taken a different approach because the facts were slightly different to him.
Tell me if I'm mistaken. Your argument isn't sufficiency of the evidence. You're claiming that the trial judge, in issuing his opinion, had placed the burden on you. Mm. And since you didn't have advanced notice that the burden was being placed on you, you didn't have the opportunity to therefore call your clients. And you're saying that was fundamentally unfair.
Well, so certainly.
Am I correct about that?
Well, right. Not even just a matter of him deciding to testify. I mean, you know, the facts in regard to my particular client were that he was outside the home. You know, the mother practically admitted that she had full-time care of the child. You know, the father pointed to the division to question her about what was going on. And, you know, he could have established via either, you know, somebody from his job coming in and testifying, or like a time card that, you know, he was not around and not around during the relevant time frame for what were perhaps injuries. You know, these parents took the child to the hospital and stayed there at the hospital and cooperated. You know, there's no sense that they would not have taken the appropriate steps to address the case before them if they knew exactly what that case would entail. So when we filed our initial petition, it was very, very much focused on this due process problem, which is, you know, I'll represent, having done this for a long time, is something we see happen. And then, you know, with the opportunity to file supplemental briefs, you know, again, generally attacking how workable this history of child burden shifting is in child welfare law.
Well, the burden shift, the way Anderson versus Sombart worked, mm-hmm. is it shifted the burden to the defendants to prosecute each other, basically.
Right.
That was the purpose of it. And if it worked in this case, it would require the parents to basically start pointing fingers at one another.
Right, right. And you know, I think when, I forget who raised the question, but would it have been appropriate for the state to call the parents to testify? Honestly, I know they had the same last names. I'm not gonna say with 100% certainty whether they're married or not, but let's just say, you know, let's say they were. You know, you run into problems then with, you know, the prosecutor's office was contacted at the beginning. So you got issues with, you know, perhaps right against self-incrimination, certainly privilege regarding testing, you know, testifying against one's spouse. But, you know, for the purposes of if they're making their own case, I guess they could waive that or, like I said, provide other documentary or testimonial evidence from some, you know, without having to necessarily turn on each other.
Other questions, anyone? Is there anything you'd like to add, Ms. Hahn?
No, I think I've covered it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Resnick.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Justice Alma, I think you make a great point that we need some pronouncement here in the sense that we, as amicus, came in on the notice and on the conditional recepsa issue. But if you stop at the statute, then that mess goes away, right? We don't need to get into those issues. And so depending what the court's going to do, if the court's going to basically pronounce that, well, the statute provides the burden. And so the trial courts and appellate division panels that are shifting burdens shouldn't be doing that. Then we don't need notice and then we don't need to deal with these other issues. But if the court is going to leave that in place, at least on some level, then certainly we echo the petitioners on the notice issue. We think respectfully should be earlier, maybe in the discovery period. And we certainly would dispute the division's position that, well, it's in the pleading, so you'll figure it out. Or maybe it's in discovery, so you'll figure it out. I mean, I think there needs to be just some clear edict there. And then in terms of the conditional burden shifting, that does raise an issue, an interesting point, in the sense that if, as what happened here, basically both parents get knocked out and there's basically then no parents left. And so if at this point you can at least save one of them, if they do decide, well, maybe we don't want to take a unified front and maybe one parent did actually cause a problem and it wasn't the other parent, then perhaps then the child would benefit for some being placed back with that parent at the end of the day. And so, but we agree, Justice, I think that we need some pronouncement so that there's direction for the lower courts, you know, under amicus. And I'll take any questions from any of the justices.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. At the core of this argument are really three fundamental misapprehensions. First, that Title IX proceedings are either quasi-criminal or punitive in nature. They are not. This court in PZ, as well as in GS, made it abundantly clear that the purpose of Title IX litigation is not to punish, but instead to protect children. To the extent appellants argue that they are also quasi-criminal, there is absolutely nothing in any law, case law that I am aware of that provides this. We do not dispute that termination of parental rights proceedings have been described as quasi-criminal in nature, but this court has repeatedly declined to import criminal protections to Title IX proceedings, where to do so would disrupt or derail the goal of Title IX litigation, which is again to protect. The second fundamental misunderstanding is the controlling statute. The division does not agree that NJSA 9:6-8.46B speaks to the burden to be allocated. It speaks certainly to the standard of proof required, which this court has held goes to the question or the interest of society in assessing the margin of error, but it does not provide that the division is to bear that burden. It specifically provides that the standard of proof is a preponderance of the evidence and that the evidence admitted at a fact finding must be competent, material, and relevant. So to the extent this court is concerned with an existing canon of case law that has contradicted, explicitly contradicted a statute, I would suggest that that statute does not speak to the burden allocation. And the more controlling statute here is NJSA 9:6-8.46A2, which is what originally gave rise to the issues of res ipsa loquitur. The third misapprehension here is this idea that the division either aspires to use conditional res ipsa loquitur or does not need it in assessing how best to protect a child. Nothing could be further from the truth. If the division has to resort to asking the court to apply this doctrine, it means that it has failed in its fundamental primary goal of finding out what happened to a child. It means that the division has been faced with a child who I think we all would agree has sustained unimaginable injuries, and that despite its best efforts, it cannot figure out that second question that Justice LaVecchia raised of who did what. But this failure is not because the division's investigation is sloppy or lazy or subpar. It's because the information the division needs to make that finding, to convince the court of that finding, is contained in an impenetrable closed circuit of potential abusers. These are the cases that conditional res ipsa loquitur has been available for 30 years to address and must remain available to protect children. These are the cases that reflect the very same principles of equity that caused this court in Anderson to find unacceptable the denial of relief to a blameless victim. And here, the stakes are much higher. As your honors heard this morning, amicus and appellants to a degree seek to undo this. Appellants also argue that they are entitled to advance notice from the court, not only as to the question of whether a burden might shift, but also when it already has. Ultimately, they advance a due process analysis, which this court has explored with them, that is focused exclusively on the child, on their rights as parents, while they argue that the trial court blindsided them and lulled them into a false sense of security when it ultimately applied a legal theory that was contained wholly within the facts the division pled. As Justice Albin has alluded to, the division does not concede that the trial court actually applied conditional res ipsa loquitur here. But even if this court finds otherwise, this analysis is wrong. First, it ignores the most fundamental interest at stake in this litigation, which is the child and the child's right to be free from harm and safe from abuse. Second, it offers this court no basis to depart from well-settled principles of pleading, which are applicable in both civil and criminal cases. And third, it is based on the mistaken and illogical premise that there is anything in the original canon of case law, beginning with NOPCO, spanning through Anderson and Chin, to support their contention that a trial court can or should allocate a burden anytime before the close of all the evidence. Because their arguments are inconsistent with this law, illogical, and place their clients at a significant disadvantage, we ask this court to affirm. I'm happy to take questions.
So turning to the statute, do you think a fair reading of the statute is when it says must be based on preponderance of the evidence, that the preponderance of the evidence can shift to the parents, that the parents have to show by preponderance of the evidence that they didn't do it? Are you suggesting that?
Yes, I don't believe that statute that Your Honor has cited speaks to who bears the burden of proof.
So you are suggesting, I just want to be clear about this, that it may be the parents who bear the burden of proving by preponderance of the evidence.
Well, I'm hardly suggesting that in a vacuum. We absolutely agree that ordinarily the division bears the burden of proof. That is clear from the case law and it is appropriate. But my point is that comes from the evolution of the case law. Just as DT imported conditional res ipsa loquitur to determine that in unique, limited circumstances, it is appropriate to shift the burden. So to the extent, I apologize.
No, it's okay.
Are you saying?
The state can call the actual parents to the stand, correct?
I'm, well,
go ahead.
No, well, actually, I would point this court to GRR's response, which is very similar to what I was going to say in response to Your Honor's question, which is that the division's hands are still limited. This court has made it clear, and even SS, in assessing the constitutional challenge, recognized that parents do have the right to invoke their right to remain silent. So it's not as simple as calling them to the stand to testify.
Well, that's up to them. If they want to invoke their right against self-incrimination, that's on them. That doesn't prevent you from calling them. If they want to invoke their right against self-incrimination, that's a different issue. This is a civil proceeding. This is not a criminal proceeding.
Well, the division does have the right to call them. I agree with that, certainly. But to the extent the purpose of calling them, can you hear me?
Yes, sure.
I'm sorry, that seemed a little strange for a second. To the extent the purpose in calling them is to assist the trier of fact to get closer to what actually happened, putting a defendant on the stand who's going to say, no, I'm invoking my right, against self-incrimination, doesn't get closer.
Well, I don't understand why you assume there will be an invocation of the right against self-incrimination in a civil case. I think it's appropriate to call the witness. If the witness invokes, that's a different issue.
Justice Altman, I agree, but SS, which assessed the constitutional challenge, and there was a case recently, and I apologize, I don't have the citation before me, in the appellate division, which indicated that the parent has that right. So no, it's not a question of whether we can call the parent. That's always permissible, and that may even be done in a case. But where the parent is part of the limited pool who will not share that knowledge, there's no reason to expect that having been called in a civil case, they'll share that knowledge at all. So the ultimate question is not whether the division has the ability to call the parent, but instead whether the division possesses the knowledge that is needed to prove who did what. And the answer to that is no. So to the extent Your Honor brought up subsection B as controlling who bears the burden of proof, I would submit that it does not.
You read subsection B to simply be establishing the level of proof that the fact finder must find in order to label the child abused or neglected. Am I understanding your argument to be simply that the fact finder, looking at the evidence that comes in, however it comes in, has to be convinced beyond the preponderance of the evidence that the child meets one of the definitions for an abused and neglected child? Is that it?
That's correct. And I would also note that this subsection 2 of the statute also differentiates explicitly between fact findings and other proceedings under the Act, which allow for the admission of evidence that is not competent. Mm-hmm. So to the extent this statute should be read to speak to who bears the burden, I don't think that was the intention at all, nor do I think that's evident anywhere in its plain language.
Well, I seem to remember that became evident when this statute was passed. There's legislative history where the legislature did speak to why they were going to a lower standard of proof on protective matters for children, as opposed to the related statutory provisions that deal with termination of parental rights and heightened considerations. But in terms of Dodd removal and these Title IX proceedings, the legislature was quite clear that they were throwing a very lighter burden in order to ensure greater protection for children.
Well, that's absolutely accurate, and that's precisely my point. But I think that the standard of proof, the level of evidence required to sustain a finding is very different. And this statute does not speak specifically to who must be the one to bear that burden. And I want to be clear, the reason I brought this up is in response to Justice Alvin's questioning and appellant's responses that this is a controlling statute and that we should not even be entertaining questions of burden shifting because we have a statute which on its face plainly indicates the division bears that burden. I do not agree with that interpretation. I do not agree with their arguments. To the contrary, my position is that A2 in NJSA 9:6-8.46A2 speaks specifically to legislative intent in allowing for the possibility that the division will not know who harmed a child. The appellate division has consistently spoken to that question and held that that statute represents traditional res ipsa loquitur principles, which allows for a finding of abuse or neglect, really abuse more often than not, where the division simply cannot point to which parent or guardian who controlled the child should be held liable for it. To the extent that conditional burden shifting developed out of that statute is where we are starting to come to this issue of notice and when the burden should be shifted. But to the extent, again, I cannot emphasize enough, to the extent that subsection B should be read to preclude any further discussion of this doctrine, frankly, I think that would be utterly inconsistent with A2, which again is very reflective of res ipsa loquitur principles.
So following up on that.
In a case such as this, if only traditional res ipsa principles apply, what's the impact? How would the case unfold as you see it?
Well, in this case specifically, the division's position is that it was traditional res ipsa, that there is nothing in the trial court's decision here that can be read to have actually shifted a burden of proof onto the parents. And that equally, there is nothing in the appellate division decision, nor in appellant's or amicus's brief, which actually pointed with a citation to that shifting. Now, to the extent the question comes, how would it have unfolded if conditional were utilized? Well, frankly, in conditional and traditional, the finding sought by the division to sustain, or the facts that need to be proved to sustain a finding, are the same. First, that the child was non-accidentally injured, and second, that the defendant seated at the table could have done it. The only difference is that in conditional res ipsa loquitur, there must be the additional layer of analysis that only the defendants seated at the table could have done that.
I'm trying to get clear. Are you arguing that conditional res ipsa is appropriate or isn't appropriate?
In this case or generally?
First, let's start generally, then we'll talk about this case, generally.
Absolutely. I think that not only is conditional res ipsa appropriate, it is absolutely necessary.
Okay.
In order to ensure that where the division, by the nature of the case, cannot know who caused the injuries, that the child does not remain unprotected.
Okay, is this a traditional or a conditional from the viewpoint of the division?
In this case, the trial court applied traditional res ipsa loquitur.
And do you agree with that?
I do agree with that,
So let's just for one moment stop there. So if you use the traditional, you have experts. I mean, so you have proof of abuse and neglect, but assume that you didn't have the experts. You'd get the inference based upon the condition of the child that this bespeaks abuse and neglect. But the traditional res ipsa isn't going to denominate who between the mother and the father did it. Do you agree?
Yes.
That's where the conditional res ipsa, it places on them the requirement to point fingers at each other or exclude themselves, right?
No, I would not agree that the ability to hold multiple defendants liable is exclusively based in conditional res ipsa.
Well, in Anderson versus Somburg, yet all those people in the operating room, and our court said, we're going to shift it to all you people, and so that you exclude yourself. So at least there's one person standing, because the court said at least one person is responsible for that. So when you're all done testifying, like, one person's going to have to be culpable. Am I correct?
Absolutely. And I certainly agree, to be clear, I certainly agree that conditional guarantees that there is at least one person, as this court in Anderson wanted to make sure happened. But I misunderstood Your Honor's question to mean that under traditional principles, a finding could not be sustained against multiple defendants. And that, okay, my apologies then in that case. But I would also note, as Your Honor noted, at least one person was the language utilized in Anderson. But I think that to the extent the question comes, why is conditional recipsalacquitur necessary if we already have the benefit of traditional recipsalacquitur, which is embodied by the statute? The issue here is, again, this tension between the rights of the parents and the goal of Title IX, which is to protect children. In this case, I absolutely agree that this finding was clearly sustained utilizing traditional recipsalacquitur principles. But this case is, well, for that reason, the division's position is this case is not exactly ideal for determining the question of conditional recipsalacquitur and whether it's necessary. Well, but
one of the reasons you're arguing traditional res ipsa, because if conditional res ipsa applies, then the defendants weren't placed on notice, and without notice, their defense was impaired. It didn't give them the opportunity of deciding whether or not each should testify. I see you're smiling. You have a response. Go ahead.
I do, Justice. Thank you. And I would first, that is frankly not the reason that the division is arguing traditional applied here. My argument is not, frankly, the division took the position that the question of conditional burden shifting at all, whether it's applicable at all in these cases, is not properly before the court, given it was raised by amicus. We raised that in both our supplemental brief and the response to amicus's brief. But more importantly, the purpose or the reason underlying that argument is a simple return to the text of the trial court's decision. This is not a situation or a case where the division is arguing now that traditional applied based on an agenda or a motive. It's a simple return to the language of the decision. The trial court at the outset made it clear that the division bore the burden of proving the child was non-accidentally injured and that the parents could have done it more likely than not. It never moved off that position. And even after the analysis of DT, which came at page 78, in the following pages, the court repeatedly reaffirmed that the division bore the burden. When it spoke of Dr. Scheller's testimony, it spoke of them having failed to rebut, not exonerate themselves, but having failed to rebut the division's prima facie case.
But that, okay, so I'm looking at 13P81. I'll just read it and then you just comment on it. The division has met its burden of proof in establishing that these parents who have elected not to come forward to testify to rebut what the division has established, certainly by a preponderance of the evidence, that the court does find that both of these parents, and then dot, dot, dot. Your adversaries are suggesting that that language there suggests that the trial court believes that the burden of persuasion had shifted to the parents. That's what they're raising their claims.
I understand.
Why aren't they correct based upon that paragraph?
They are not correct. Because what the court found there, again, was that the division had met its burden of proof, had met a prima facie case. The next question, though, if we don't read that in isolation, we have to look at the remainder of the decision as far as how the trial court assessed the evidence that the defendants put forward. Stopping there, frankly, would have been enough for the court to simply make a finding. But it had to go on to assess Dr. Scheller's testimony and what evidence the parents did put forward. The fact that the trial court noted that the parents elected not to testify is not dispositive of what burden it did or did not put on them. It simply notes, which the court in JL found was appropriate, that they elected to present a different defense. The question is how the court weighed that defense. The court ultimately weighed that defense as failing to rebut. And I would note that in JL, which appellants cite a great deal, the same question came before the appellate division as to what burden, if at all, the trial court had actually placed on the parents. They argued that the trial court had shifted the burden of proof to them. The division agreed, and the law guardian argued that the trial court had not done so and that that was proper. So there was a I apologize.
We've already had a case that has said that if advance notice is given to the parents, that the standard will be clear and convincing evidence. Then we know that this finding can be used in prong one in the termination. Are your arguments the same? If the clear and convincing standard is used so that the finding of abuse and neglect will satisfy prong one, which you said is, are you following me?
I'm sorry, is Your Honor asking whether we have the same arguments we essentially advanced in RD, or is it a different case here, or?
Is it a different case?
It is a different case. The finding, I think going back to Your Honor's initial questions, the standard of proof is articulated in the statute. To the extent the division seeks to change that, I agree that there needs to be notice. Conditional res ipsa loquitur is not a standard. It is a legal theory used to reach a result. Now in these cases, and in the history of this court in New Jersey, the division and any plaintiff must only fairly apprise the parties of the possibility that such legal theories will apply. The facts, it's a question for the fact, whether the facts put the parties on notice. Now, I would submit that that has been reaffirmed multiple times, including by this court in ARG. There, the court actually held that a citation to the statute, which allowed the division to seek a waiver of reasonable efforts, was not enough. More important was the facts that the division put forth and intended to put forth to support that. Here in this case, the division pled facts more than sufficient to put the parties on notice that conditional burden shifting might apply. Specifically, that the division believed that only the parents had access to the child, and obviously that his injuries were non-accidental. This doctrine, this is not like DT, where the court had imported a new doctrine. This has been in place for 32 years. To the extent that appellants point to the statement on December 1st, 2017, by the one defense counsel that this was not her burden, I submit that that argument takes the quote extremely out of context. There, the defense counsel indicated that her expert had not prepared a report in time for trial, but that she was willing to go forward because it was not her burden to present first, but that she was willing to go forward. However, she acknowledged that it would be unfair to the division to do so, and the court ultimately adjourned the fact-finding. So to the extent they hang their hats on that one statement as a request by defense counsel to somehow determine the allocation of the burden, I would disagree. Now to the second, to the issue of notice, and I think Your Honor, Justice Alvin raised this, or maybe it was Justice Lavecchia, I apologize. To the extent this was raised, they presented a defense. They presented a very strong defense, which had the trial court accepted it, likely would have exonerated both of them. Their defense went to the key question of whether GRR Jr.'s injuries were actually non-accidental.
Yeah, but that's just presuming that wasn't conditional, because if it's conditional, the burden shifts to the parents, then particularly the father here has an increased incentive to pull himself away from the mother and say, I was hardly at home. I was working. I came home late at night. There would have been a much greater incentive for him to testify, since the mother was the primary child care giver here. Do you agree?
Well, we don't dispute certainly that those are the facts, but I don't necessarily, and I also agree that conditional burden shifting does incentivize parents to come forward knowing that they will be held liable if they don't offer something. But here I submit that there was never a question that the division sought to have GRR liable. So to the extent it's a question here of he didn't know that he could be held liable, I submit that that is incredibly disingenuous and totally contrary to the division's own finding, which was articulated in its investigation and was provided in advance to the parties. The division also removed this child and sought to restrain the contact to supervised between both parents and the child. So while I would agree with Your Honor, Justice Albin, that conditional does incentivize the search for truth, which frankly is a goal in all of our litigation, not just limited to Title IX, but to the extent the father has made any showing that he erroneously relied on the idea that he would not bear the burden, I submit that that is not anywhere found in these facts. Now, I do want to address the issue, and I think Your Honor brought it up a little bit the question of when the burden can actually be allocated. And I would point this court to appellants' own briefs in that regard. Appellants argue that conditional burden shifting that the court applied, appellants argue that they need advance notice of when the burden is shifting. Today, JRR indicates that she would like that to come at the close of the division's case. However, both also argue that Dr. Scheller's testimony should have precluded allocation of the burden to them. That is fundamentally inconsistent with what they ask for, and it is also inconsistent with the true principle of due process, which requires that they have a meaningful opportunity to respond and to actually defeat conditional burden shifting. Returning to Your Honor, Justice Albin's reference in Anderson, Anderson, Chin, Napko, Blitz, which counsel referenced today, all made clear that allocation of the burden should not come until the trial court and finder of fact has heard all of the evidence. And that principle should apply here, where, again, appellants argue that Dr. Scheller's testimony should have prevented the court from applying traditional or conditional burden shifting. But if we give them what they want, Dr. Scheller's testimony would be rendered irrelevant to that question.
I'm trying to understand what you just said.
Sure.
No, you may have been very clear. You're saying that the conditional res ipsa won't apply until all the evidence is in, like the defendants won't know until the close of the case that the burden has shifted to them?
Well, that is how it's been traditionally applied, Justice Albin. And I would note that
you're saying that's the way it applied in Anderson. How would anyone know? How would anyone have the ability, okay, to either exculpate themselves or implicate the other people in the room, like in an Anderson type of case, if the case is already over when they're told that the conditional res ipsa applies?
Well, it certainly is how it was applied in Anderson. Anderson specified that at the close of all the evidence, the court needs to allocate the burden. And the reason for that, I submit, is to avoid substantial prejudice on anyone who relies on a premature ruling. To that end, I would point this court to the case of Blitz versus Hutchinson, which is 252 NJ Super 580, where the trial court, made a premature decision on where the burden should be allocated. In that case, the plaintiff had sustained a liver laceration and sued multiple doctors. During the course of the pretrial hearings, as well as at trial, in response to statements by witnesses during colloquies, the court was emphatic that this would be an Anderson type case. After hearing from the defense expert, the court changed its mind and ultimately charged the jury with a traditional res ipsa loquitur charge. The plaintiff appealed, arguing that he had relied on the trial court's representations to his detriment, and Justice Coleman, then Judge Coleman, writing for the appellate division, agreed and reversed the case. The bottom line is that in these cases, having the trial court issue a premature decision on half the evidence, and the half of that evidence that is not from the party who has exclusive control of those facts, requires the attorneys and the parties to try the case not in the context of the facts or the evidence, but instead in the context of what the judge misunderstood the law to be. To the extent Your Honor appears concerned at this idea that a party, a parent, needs to guess at what's going on, I again return to my answer to Your Honor's earlier question, which is that the only difference is whether other individuals had access to the child. And that fact lies solely within the defendant's control. They are the parents or guardians. They are the ones who have that information. There would be no question, there simply would be no way for the division to have been with this family for, you know, however many weeks or days leading up to the injury. So to the extent—
Is there an opportunity to impose a different burden than one you're talking about with the court having to essentially say, I'm shifting the burden. I'm thinking of an analogy that's not all that close, but that is that when in civil cases, when a party that is not present at the time of the verdict, be it for a settlement reason, for a dismissal or whatever, the burden goes on the party that it will seek to impose fault on that absent party to tell the remaining party, we're going to try to allocate fault to this party that's no longer going to be here. Is it possible that to impose the burden on the state to advise the defendants that it may seek to allocate some of the burden to them? That doesn't require a final decision because, as you point out, the court wants to look at as much evidence as possible before making a final decision. But it does provide the parties it does provide the defendants with some notice that they may be put in the position where they are essentially trying to shift burden to one another.
While we don't necessarily agree that that's necessary under due process, we are willing to do that. So in answer to Your Honor's question, yes, the division recognizing the value of additional safeguards, even to the extent that they don't go directly to the question of due process, is willing in these cases, recognizing the due process and the value of additional safeguards, to advise the defendants and the court prior to the close of the discovery period that if the proofs, that it believes that conditional burden shifting may apply, presuming, of course, the proofs pan out the way the division initially believed they will. So yes, the division is willing to provide that notice. Again, I don't believe it is a question of a deprivation of due process, but to the extent it could alleviate any potential concerns or potential claims such as those advanced in this case, we're willing to do that.
Questions? Anything you'd like to add, Ms. Gregory?
Just briefly. While I recognize and acknowledge the concerns articulated particularly by Justice Alvin as to application of this doctrine in the context of a relationship between a parent and a child, I would ask this court to recall that the purpose of Title IX is not to remove from the law anything that may have an adverse effect on a parent. It is to protect the child. Conditional res ipsa loquitur was designed originally by this court to strike a balance between a blameless victim and those who are in the position to tell us what happened. It is absolutely necessary in child protective services cases, and without it, children will not just be harmed, they will die. Thank you.
Can I throw one thing in there, just to clarify for myself? You very eloquently argued in favor of maintaining conditional res ipsa. I get that. But in this particular case, you're comfortable that traditional res ipsa or conditional res ipsa would have resulted in the same outcome?
We are in this particular case, which is why, frankly, as we stated at the outset, this is not the ideal vehicle for this court to determine the necessity of conditional res ipsa loquitur at all.
Thank you. Mr. Devlin.
Thank you, and good afternoon again, Your Honors. The court is asked today to consider the competing interest in a Title IX matter. And once again, as it has done before, find that the well-being of the child is paramount. Courts of chancery are routinely called upon to craft ways to protect these interests. Here, the trial court recognized the disadvantage to one party who, because of his infancy, could not engage in the proceedings on the same footing as defendants. Shifting the burden of persuasion in unique circumstances such as this recognizes one of the most basic functions of society, carried out and fulfilled by the law of protecting vulnerable children. Precedent has established guidelines following Anderson in 1975 to be met before allowing a shift in the burden of persuasion. In 1999, in the estate of Chin matter, This court identified three elements, took Anderson and distilled it into three discrete elements, which must be present to shift the burden. And those are met here. First, the party to be benefited must be wholly and entirely blameless. Here, the child was behind closed doors, wholly reliant upon his parents to be free from abuse. Second, the nature of the injury must be consistent with neglect. Here, the medical evidence found credible establishes that the child was abused, and there are three distinct facets of that element, of that evidence. The imaging, the external signs, and the chemical imbalance of the Lepias enzymes. And third, all plausible defendants must be before the court. Here, it was conclusively shown that only the two parents, GRR and JRR, had access, were caregivers, either jointly or individually, at the time of the injury. Just 2 years ago, in an administrative appeal, in the matter of Yupt, this court did not shift the burden of persuasion, but reaffirmed a court's ability to do so, justifying it by noting the disparity one party may have in access to evidence and information, the fairness overall to all parties, and the need for a complete record. Here, as a finding of abuse will inform further court orders and possibly service and restrictions, that need for a complete record is paramount. In this matter, each defendant could have either challenged that the child was not abused or that they were not the abuser, or both. Each had very experienced trial counsel who chose to challenge the nature of the injuries. Defendants asked this court to essentially reevaluate the evidence found credible, essentially a second trial. At trial, there was no claim of surprise by defendants as to the medical testimony presented, and there was no claim that they were being treated unfairly or prejudiced during the investigatory period. And in this matter, to analogize it to DT, if the appellate division in DT had not done what it did, you would have a child going back to a known hazardous situation, placed with two individuals who, one of which sexually abused the child. The child would have been knowingly placed in a risk of harm. And second, while 9.846 sets forth the burden of proof, it does not foreclose equitable doctrines, such as conditional res ipsa loquitur. And finally, as to res ipsa loquitur, this court has spoken several times about the doctrine and upheld it. Today is only asked that this infant, unable to speak for himself, be analogized to the sedated patient in Anderson. And with that, I thank the court. Receive any questions.
Mr. Devlin, what's the current status of the child? How old is the child, and in whose custody is the child?
The child, I believe, is almost two. There is a guardianship proceeding concluding, and the child is placed with non-relative caregivers.
Do you know whether or not in the guardianship hearing, the finding in this case is being used to prove factor number one in the four-prong test? Do you know?
It is my understanding that it is not. It is more focused on parental inability rather than the discrete situation here of physical abuse.
Are you suggesting that the state couldn't prove its case without DT? Because the attorney general is saying, look, we have all this evidence, we have traditional res ipsa, we don't need this conditional burden shift. And I heard you just say, oh, without this conditional burden shift, the child is going back to the parents.
Correct.
So are you suggesting that that without the conditional burden shift, the division had not submitted sufficient evidence to either prove abuse or neglect or the people who actually committed it? Is that what you're saying?
Well, if I may, the division presented by beyond the preponderance of the evidence that the child was abused or neglected. But the problem in this case that the trial judge noticed was the evidence couldn't point to who was the abuser and who negligently supervised the child. One parent likely was the active abuser and the other had a failure to protect the child. The court couldn't identify which was which. And so that's where the DT principles kick in.
You're at odds with the Attorney General, because the Attorney General has said the trial court did not apply the conditional res ipsa, and you're saying it did, correct?
Yes, it did. Traditional res ipsa loquitur, really that is in every case where the division makes their finding of a prima facie case of abuse or neglect. That's the commonplace case. This is an exceptional case where this equitable doctrine needs to be applied.
Okay,
just saying that because it's rare for the parent to admit being the one to have struck the child or done whatever it is that caused the injuries that the division proves?
Yes, it's a rarity to have a situation where we know one of two people did something bad to the child, but we can't figure out exactly who.
Right. More often than not, it's the injuries that are brought to the attention of the division, either from outsiders or hospital personnel. But the cause is left to be determined.
Yes.
Inferred.
Exactly. And that's why, as the trial court in black and white said, it is a conditional res ipsa loquitur case.
Mm-hmm. Just where, in the where, fact where, did, it, where did the trial fact. Court say that?
I'm sorry?
Where did the trial court say that?
In its decision, it cited DT. It said this is a parallel situation to that in DT. In the oral decision. I do not have the page in front of me.
With respect to the mother who admitted that the child was in her constant care. There's, at least with respect to her, there's no need for this conditional burden shift. The state, she admitted, and the division proved that the child was in her constant care. Am I mistaken about that?
No, Your Honor. But it's also shown clearly that the father worked approximately 3 days a week and the rest of the time he was home. So he had access, which is one of the key elements that the appellate division in prior burden shifting cases has looked to. Who has the access? Now in JL, there were too many people with access. There were too many people and some of them weren't even identified.
So this is what he's saying. Now you can respond to particularly the father. The father is saying, I would have liked to have known that this conditional res ipsa applied, because if it did, if I knew that the burden was going to fall on me, I would have testified. So I was denied notice because I was denied notice. I was denied due process. What do you have to say about that?
Your Honor, in January 2018, the father was provided with the results of the investigation summary that he was being substantiated for abuse. And why was he being substantiated for abuse? Because he was part of this pair of defendants that caused the abuse. And he had his own individual counsel, as all parents do. He had his own attorney who was looking out for GRR's interests and his interests only. So at some point, a strategical decision was made to go forward with a joint expert witness, but that certainly wasn't, the die wasn't cast before trial by the division. These two independent attorneys adopted that strategy of their own free choice.
Other questions for Mr. Devlin? Anything you'd like to close with?
No, Your Honors. I would just ask the court to uphold conditional res ipsa loquitur as a device to be used in very discreet, appropriate situations for the protection of vulnerable children. Thank you.
Thank you. Both counsel had reserved very brief rebuttal. Ms. Kalik?
Yes, Your Honor. Just a few quick points. Number one is addressing what the Law Guardian is saying about, and I guess the Attorney General too, that somehow the mother admitted that she was the sole caretaker for the child, or the, you know, we really have to be careful here what we say that the mother admitted to. According to the record, she stated that she was the primary caregiver, but we have an issue here where this mother only spoke Popti, which is a very rare dialect from Guatemala. And it's clear from the record that having to go through two different translators from Popti to Spanish to English and back and forth, that there's a lot of information that might have been lost, including whether or not a sister was involved with the care and regarding how much time the father actually cared for the child. Just to keep in mind that the mother never testified that she was completely and solely responsible for the child. Another issue is with regard to the division claiming that the trial court didn't apply conditional res ipsa or the appellate division. I mean, the appellate division on page 19 of his decision quotes DT and affirms the fact, says that the correct burden shifting paradigm was used. There's really no other basis to claim that. And also the division's argument about notice, the complaint provided no notice at all that this was going to be a traditional, even a traditional burden shifting case. There was no citation to the statute to give notice.
Can I ask you a question there?
Yes.
You just made a comment about mother never testified that. Mother never testified at all, did she?
That's correct, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
And the father never testified at all, correct?
Correct.
Is there a point in time in the transcript where the court discusses with them or their counsel about testifying?
Not that I'm aware of.
That's all. Just curious.
Getting back to what else did I want to point out? I wanted to point out that there was a case dealing with the parents' right against the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. That was SS, that's 275 New Jersey Super 173. The appellate division dealt with this issue of whether it was a violation of the Fifth Amendment to force defendants to testify in these Title IX actions when the conditional res ipsa was being applied, and the court found it was not a violation because the court reasoned that the defendants had other means of rebutting the testimony through experts or some other way besides just testifying. But I think this is a concern because I knew another case, CJR, recognized that there's an unconstitutional asymmetry between if you're using a burden shifting paradigm like under a res ipsa, conditional res ipsa, and then using that as a preclusive effect in a Title 30 hearing should never be allowed. So, you know, Title 30, the burden of proof always remains on the division, and it should always remain on the division in this case as well. Thank you.
Ms. Hung.
sorry, need to unmute. I apologize. I would say anything these presentations have made clear here is that they're, you know, since 1988 with DT, we've been in kind of, it's been expanded well beyond its initial intent, which is monitorship of a child. There's a great deal of confusion, terminology, both in the current trial court opinion, the appellate division opinion, and cases back and forth and up and down the line between Anderson, where it's very murky, and this is court's words, with these allocations of persuasion, production, and what all that means. So therefore, we're before you for some procedural guideposts, certainly as to how this should all play out. Now, attach on to a little bit what Amika said about like leaving the parents here to just figure it out. I would submit that the complaint was hardly unequivocal in bringing up the ARG decision. You know, the burden was put on the state to very clearly, formally give defendants notice when it was going to seek the relief from reasonable efforts. Here, I mean, it would be very easy to just cite the prima facie portion of the statute in the complaint and go forward from there. Here, you know, the complaint was hardly unequivocal. You had Dr. DeJong being quoted in there about like, well, you know, if it weren't for the meningitis, you know, I don't know. And then as far as like the timing of the discovery, you know, the division investigated us for, I believe, 8 months. I mean, it did take them some time to investigate this, and that investigation summary not being produced until, you know, just a couple months before trial. Same thing with expert reports. You know, it was not an easy, straightforward case, it doesn't seem, right? And the parents were not, you know, having the entire case before it for months and months or anything of this kind. You know, as to, well, one thing the court seemed to be asking, I do have the cite for you, as far as like, when the trial court got into calling this specifically a DT case and the important issue of who did what, that's volume 13 of the transcript and roughly mostly on page 79, I would say. And then as far as, gosh, the court had a question about where something else was raised. Let me look back to me. But I would say this court's assistance is required. And there's no harm to having a defined procedure as to where and how and when and by whom some notice of what burden, traditional, conditional, production, persuasion, has shifted to the defendants. It doesn't result in any harm to the child. If you look at, you know, Santosky versus Kramer's discussion, the state has all the power before it to mount a case against parents, all the resources. You know, they can remove a child without a prior court order. We've got 9:6-8.50, which was what was used in DT. And for that matter, you know, if time and circumstances warrant, the state can move forward with a termination of parental rights proceeding absent a Title IX abuse or neglect finding. So the state has many mechanisms to protect a child. Certainly, you know, we appellants, we parent, you know, representing the parents, are not here to say there's, you know, any reason to not be concerned about what happened here. Just that there's other, that there should be procedure to be followed, some clarity, you know, as to how this is all supposed to play out. And one important distinction, of course, is going back to the Anderson decision. You know, that was from, you know, throwing one defendant after, you know, against the other. And that's for money damages, not anything implicating fundamental constitutional rights. So we're just in a completely different universe here. And I take exception with the state claiming that a Title IX proceeding is not punitive in nature. I mean, this court itself in the YM case said that a Title IX trial is a prosecution with significant lifelong consequences of being on the lifelong registry as a child abuser. And as far as the quasi-criminal nature of the proceedings, you know, that's in re guardianship of Dotson. There's the GS case. So, you know, definitely that recognition has been there. And that's the reason why constitutional protections, such as the right to effective assistance of counsel, and even in the CW appellate division case, there being some, you know, some measure of a right of confrontation of a witness when it comes to, you know, hearsay testimony. So, you know, what started out as a civil law, tort law principle got applied for a very limited purpose into a child welfare space. And since that time, it's just kind of blown up in a, quite frankly, unmanageable fashion where parents are just being expected to figure it out. And, you know, it's the plain here, the trial court was more concerned about the who did what you know, even if we were to say they got to first base, which of course, you know, being an advocate for my client, I'm going to say, no, we, you know, rebutted that. But assuming they got to first base with that prima facie case, something coming forward to rebut, well, nothing noticed them that they were going to need to actually, you know, not just come forward with an explanation, but actually coming forward with exculpatory evidence. And as far as like the state bringing forward, or pardon me, the defense bringing forward an expert, I don't know that I follow the state's reasoning that how, you know, once they did that, they didn't need to be worried about exonerating themselves. I mean, clearly, you know, you got a two-step inquiry in these burden shifting cases. So I'm not sure why that was a wrong thing to do. But in any event, I would ask that the decision below be reversed and that this court recognize, as has been precedent, that, you know, DT burden shifting of the actual burden of persuasion has been limited to narrow cases of monitorship. The state has its remedies to protect children. And certainly at a minimum, some sort of guidance is needed here as to different kinds of burdens, how they're allocated, when, by whom, how.
Thank you, counsel. And thank you to all counsel for the helpful argument.